Alright, you guys are probably over it by now, because for us, you know, we're still in the clinic seeing patients, and you guys are like, I want to go to the bar already. I heard it. So I'm June, I'm one of the genetic counselors. I was you one day. I actually was a failed PhD student in molecular biology in your very program. And I hated being in the lab, so that's how I became a genetic counselor. So I actually had a lecture on genetic counseling, which kind of led me down my path, and full circle, I am a genetic counselor here at Roswell, and today I'm going to talk to you about hereditary breast cancer risk. So today we really want to kind of get an understanding that there's multiple different genes, multiple conditions that can contribute to breast cancer risk. Describe that there's different methodologies of how we approach testing. So again, you probably are very aware of BRCA1 and 2. We now do multi-gene panels pretty routinely, and so we get a lot of surprises about genetic changes related to cancer risk in families. And certainly describe then kind of the follow-through on the clinical end that this is very important for treatment planning, screening, and risk reduction. I know you had a lecture already by my colleague Molly, and she took some of my slides, and so this probably looks familiar. So genetic counselors, we're master's level trained medical providers. We are experts in hereditary disease. Unlike a lot of other medical providers, when you go to the doctor's office, though you might be there for an hour, you spend 10 minutes with your doctor. We are face-to-face with our patients for 60 to 90 minutes, reviewing their personal and family medical histories, and then counseling them regarding all these hereditary conditions that may be in the family, and facilitating genetic testing for them. When we're kind of approaching these different families, the thing to also keep in mind is as your health information changes, so does the health of your family members. So if you go to the doctor, your doctor should be asking about your family history every year when you get your physical, and it's even very more important probably for an oncologist at this point to make sure that they're routinely updating the family history and updating that risk assessment for hereditary risk. The American Society of Clinical Oncology recommends getting at least three generations of a family tree, documenting diagnoses, age of onset, clarifying diagnoses, and again, updating that pretty routinely. Okay, if we use the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines specifically for testing for hereditary breast cancer risk, they're written really with the thought of BRCA 1 and 2 in mind. So BRCA 1 and 2, again, are the most common explanation for hereditary breast cancer risk, and these are specific testing guidelines that are established within by the NCCN panel. So breast cancer at or under age 45, a triple negative breast cancer diagnosed at or under age 60, a male diagnosed with breast cancer, women with bilateral breast cancer, especially given the first diagnosis is at an early onset, a malignant phylloides tumor, so that's actually not related to BRCA1 and 2, that's related to a different condition called Li-Fraumeni syndrome, which we'll talk about, and then a combination, so a breast cancer diagnosis at any age, but a suggestive family history. Are there other cancers in the family kind of giving us that red flag? Two other family members diagnosed with any of those cancers means they would meet testing criteria. If there's a single ovarian cancer in the family, that would be enough. If there's certain ethnic backgrounds, so certain ancestral backgrounds have a higher frequency of certain genetic changes, so to be carriers for certain conditions. About one in maybe 500 or 600 of us have a BRCA mutation just walking around the United States. It's one in 40 people who are of Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, and it's three common changes, so that can impact a risk assessment. And then for people who have more than one type of cancer themselves, do they have rare types of cancers? So that's what needs to go into looking at some of these personal and family history. When we're doing genetic testing or assessing a family, it's really important to know who the best person is in the family. Certainly, testing an affected individual is more beneficial because in them we're looking for the basis of their cancer diagnosis, and so that can give us a refined risk for unaffected family members. So if I have a BRCA mutation, we know my children each have a 50-50 chance of having that genetic change. If they don't inherit it, they're followed at population guidelines, so it can be very informative for other people in the family. Okay, So you've heard about BRCA1 and 2 before. This part's pretty old hat for you, I'm sure. So with BRCA1 and 2, they're always lumped together because certainly they work together in the family or in the body. And when we look at families, there's overlapping cancer risks, but overall BRCA1 is associated with the higher end of cancer risk for breast and ovarian cancers, but BRCA2 has a larger spectrum of cancers that we see. So while we still see breast and ovarian cancers, we see other types of cancers more commonly in families with BRCA2 mutations. So that could be the male breast cancers, the pancreatic cancers, the prostate cancers, colon cancers, this wider spectrum. Okay, so a straight up family with breast cancer. So this is our initial patient. So at 38, she was diagnosed with bilateral breast cancer. Her sister was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 40. So these circles are women, squares are men. So these are our patient's siblings. Here's her parents. So her mother was diagnosed with breast cancer at 34. And up through her grandmother, who passed away at a really young age, she has a set of our patient's first cousins, once removed, diagnosed with breast cancer. So this is a pretty classic family. We're looking for lots of red flags. We see lots of women diagnosed with breast cancer. All of them are young. But interestingly, up here, there's a male with breast cancer as well. So in assessing this family, we looked at BRCA1 and 2, and lo and behold, this woman has a BRCA1 mutation. What is the management guidelines for individuals with BRCA1 mutations? Well, it's certainly to start screenings for female breast cancer risk at a younger age and do them more rigorously. I'm sure Dr. Young will talk about screening methodologies and information used to do staging workups. So instead of just doing a mammogram with women who are at higher risk to develop breast cancer, we add in breast MRIs as a screening tool. Those are typically separated by 6 months, so they're having annual exams for each of those. So a mammogram 6 months later, MRI, mammogram, MRI. We typically avoid, yep.
I just had a big question.
Go ahead.
If a person's coming in for screening and, like, say a woman comes in asking, like, if her species can develop breast cancer, and say, like, her father has BRCA1 mutation.
BRCA, not BRCA. So we'll talk about that.
Sorry,
oh, no. BRCA. It's myriad is bad. Go ahead.
BRCA1, say, like, mm-hmm. the father had it, but not, like, the mother. Like, is there, like, a risk?
Excellent question. BRCA1 and 2 are on the 13th and 17th chromosomes. They're equally inherited between men and women. It does not matter if this was inherited through mom or through dad. Excellent question. There's a lot of doctors that don't get that and still think mom's side of the family is the only thing that matters. So that's a really good question. When we think of BRCA mutations, those women specifically with BRCA1 mutations, those are the ones we're much more worried about when it comes to breast and ovarian cancer risk. So certainly we start MRIs at about 25, add in mammograms at 30, and that's to avoid radiation exposure to the breast tissue at a younger age. And also it's a more sensitive tool just to do breast MRIs at a younger age because of the density of the breast tissue. And certainly consider ways to reduce risk. A risk-reducing mastectomy, so a prophylactic mastectomy, is a really major surgery for a woman to undergo. And for women who are facing this level of risk, upwards and above an 80% lifetime risk, that could be the right answer for them. So actually in the family we just saw, I actually saw this woman's daughter, and she's very interested in doing that procedure because look at what she's seeing, okay? When it comes to ovarian cancer, we are not good at screening for ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancers are certainly not as common as breast cancers, so the risk for a woman to develop ovarian cancer is less than 2%. Again, women with BRCA1 mutations, that risk is about a 44% lifetime risk. We can do ultrasounds to take a look at the ovaries, some blood work. The CA125 is a protein produced by the ovaries to get a sense if there's something going on. They are notoriously inaccurate, and there's tons of false positives and false negatives. So really the recommendation is to remove the ovaries and fallopian tubes, ideally between 35 and 40 years of age, especially for women with BRCA1 mutations. Men have higher risks for prostate cancer if they have a BRCA mutation. That's, again, more strongly associated with BRCA2. But in men with BRCA1 mutations, we still start screenings a little bit differently for them, perhaps considering doing prostate screenings a little bit younger. So doing the PSA test, which is a blood test, and then doing a physical exam of the prostate, the digital rectal exam. And then from a breast cancer perspective, to do a clinical breast exam yearly starting at 35. So that's kind of the interventions for screenings. We are now to the age of personalized medicine. So it used to be that we did genetic testing for people, and it was really to give them an answer of why they developed their cancer, to maybe be proactive to see if there's other types of cancers that they may be at risk for. And to refine risk for family members. But now there is targeted treatments for people who have BRCA-associated cancers, and those are PARP inhibitors. So BRCA1 and 2 are responsible for double-stranded DNA break repair. PARPs, or polyaribose polymerases, are single-stranded break repair. So if DNA is still being corrected in the body with BRCA1 and 2 being faulty, there's still that backup mechanism for DNA repair in the cells. So those cancer cells continue to grow and develop. So if we block that polyaribose polymerase by this PARP inhibitor, that's removing very efficiently DNA repair in those cells. So that is killing off those cancer cells with BRCA mutations. Unfortunately, if somebody has a BRCA mutation, it's everywhere in their body. You can get a lot of systemic side effects. But some cancers, there's BRCA mutations only in the cancer cells and they're not inherited. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But this is an option for individuals from a treatment perspective. We talked about that. Okay, so here's a different situation. So this patient we initially saw when she was 50. She was diagnosed with colon cancer. Kind of young. So we did screening for a condition called Lynch syndrome. Have you guys heard about Lynch syndrome, HNPCC? Okay, so we know that the most significant risk is for cancer of the colon, with an upwards of an 80% lifetime risk for colon cancer. And in looking at the family tree, not wowed. Mom had a lymphoma in her 70s and breast cancer at 82. Maternal uncle had prostate at 80. And grandmother, it was a wishy-washy history. Maybe in her 50s she had breast cancer. Maybe she had another breast cancer. Maybe she had a GYN cancer in her 40s. That, you know, sounds suspicious more for a cervical cancer, not an ovarian cancer. So it was kind of wishy-washy. There weren't a lot of details. And so we kind of screened her for Lynch syndrome and said, sorry, this isn't going on in you. We don't have an explanation, but don't got to worry as rigorously for your children or other family members. She came back to see us after she was diagnosed with bilateral breast cancers at 58, and in the same year, her sister was diagnosed with breast cancer at 54. Completely different situation now. So we have 5 breast cancers in 4 women over 3 generations, lots of red flags here, and actually they also have a BRCA1 mutation. So we do see, again, other types of cancers in families with BRCA mutations. It happens more commonly in BRCA2, but it still happens in people with BRCA1 mutations. Okay, prostate cancer. We can see, again, prostate cancers more commonly. So we kind of get interesting ways of how patients get to us sometimes. In this case, we were seeing a patient because of her personal history of breast cancer, and her husband came along to the appointment. And they were really concerned about risks for their girls because of her history of breast cancer. But he ended up sharing that he had prostate cancer, and so did his brother, and so did his dad. So all of a sudden, kind of some red flags are going up. And his history was actually more significant than hers. She had breasts in her 50s and really a breast in the 80s over here. There's kind of nothing in this family tree. So he made his own appointment, and he came in. And when we took his family tree, kind of lit up. So we did hear about the prostate cancer in his brother and his dad. But when we go over to mom's side of the family, he has 2 first cousins with ovarian cancers, 3 first cousins once removed with early onset breast cancers, and these women were tested. 2 of them have BRCA mutations. So this would have been important for him to know about say before he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, we might have been watching him more closely. And he actually has what's called a Gleason 7 prostate cancer. Did you learn about a Gleason score already? So it's that score of 2 to 10 that from a pathology perspective tells us how aggressive a prostate cancer is. It combines two different numbers from the pathology. So Gleason 7 is on the more aggressive side for a prostate cancer. And in men with BRCA mutations, we do see more aggressive prostate cancers. They tend to be diagnosed at younger ages, so under 60 or 65. So in this family, of course, we're worried about breast cancer risk now for his girls, but they presented with these prostate cancers. So again, it's important to take a family history and assess the family tree for more than just breast cancer when it comes to hereditary risk. And we talked about a lot of these already. Okay. So here is a lovely, lovely lady who was diagnosed with breast cancer at 32. So an early onset breast cancer is anything under 50. 32 is really young to be diagnosed with breast cancer. And she was treated in the community. Her doctor didn't offer her any genetic testing, didn't do any testing with her. I'm not exactly sure why. She was then diagnosed with a rare type of cancer, a sarcoma. So this was a smooth muscle tumor that was malignant in her leg. And that was at 40, and that was at Roswell. So now we have two young cancers, and one is rare. The way she finally got to us, actually, is she was diagnosed with a third cancer. She wasn't referred by her doctor at Roswell. She was seeing another doctor in the community who caught that she had three young cancers. So here is our patient. and there's a whole lot of nothing in her family. One cousin with breast cancer over here. Okay, and she's got a huge family. Sometimes a personal history is enough to warrant looking more closely. This patient's mother was very anxious about her daughter's cancer history and actually had genetic counseling before I saw my patient. She did a panel test, so she did genetic testing instead of just for two genes. She did a 32-gene panel. She actually was found to have a mutation in a gene called BRIP1. BRIP1 is associated with about a 10 to 12% lifetime risk for ovarian cancer. There's no ovarian cancers in the family. There's growing evidence of breast cancer risk. So she kind of had this little red flag come up, but we're trying to still figure out what was going on in her daughter. So when I saw her daughter, she was actually diagnosed with colon cancer at 42. So that was her third cancer, and again, young for a colon cancer. We did the exact same panel as her mom had, so she had a 32-gene panel, and she has a mutation in TP53. So this is a diagnosis of that Lee-Fraumeni syndrome. Have you heard about Lee-Fraumeni before? Okay, so Dr. Lee and Dr. Fraumeni first described this condition, and we really thought we would see a lot of red flags through a family history of rare cancers, young cancers in people, and you can see she's the only one. 20% of the time, these are related to de novo mutations. So it can happen brand new in a person. And this has huge impacts on her medical management, and she's got two young boys. So originally we thought it was this SBLA, so sarcoma, breast, brain, leukemia, lymphoma, and adrenocortical carcinomas, and that was kind of the core cancer group we would see in families with Lee-Fraumeni, and that's the clinical criteria to give somebody a diagnosis of this condition or kind of based on this core group of cancers. But now that we're doing these multi-gene panels, TP53 is on every single one. So we're testing people like never before for Lee-Fraumeni syndrome, and we're getting surprises left and right. I just had a woman who is 77 and has Lee-Fraumeni syndrome, and her first cancer was at 77. So it can be very variable. Classically, we think about greater than a 90% risk to develop a cancer by age 60. The risk for cancers are really diverse. Almost every type of cancer has been seen in families with Lee-Fraumeni syndrome, with only a couple of exceptions. It's one of the rare conditions related to cancer risk that we actually would care in early life. So we would test children for this condition because there is risk for childhood, adolescent, teenage cancers. And certainly if a patient survives one cancer, they can get multiple malignancies throughout their lifetime. The current recommendations are really to do a head-to-toe exam of the patient every year. Full body MRI plus a brain MRI every year, with the addition of other targeted cancer screenings that we do for all of us. So mammograms, breast MRIs, colonoscopies, skin check. Something important for people with Li-Fraumeni syndrome, we want to try to avoid radiation if possible, because that could help along a secondary malignancy happening. So if a woman's diagnosed with breast cancer and she has a lumpectomy, the standard of care is typically to do radiation treatments on the remaining breast tissue to make sure we kind of got that bed really well treated. Women with Li-Fraumeni syndrome, we want to avoid doing that, and so we would probably counsel them that more likely a mastectomy would be an appropriate approach to treating their breast cancer. In testing her boys, I did see both of them, and one was positive. Okay, who to test? So we saw a lady, so she was 44 with her breast cancer, and in 2009 she had genetic testing of BRCA1 and 2. Here's where I talk about the BRCA stuff. So in doing genetic testing for BRCA1 and 2, historically there was one laboratory, Myriad Genetics, who had the patent on BRCA1 and 2, and so they basically were the only ones in the United States doing clinical testing of that of those two genes. So they had a monopoly. And so they basically built a company around their BRCA analysis test. So it's kind of brainwashed everyone that these BRCA genes have to be evaluated and through Myriad, and we listen to whatever Myriad says. Because they developed additional technology to look at the genes differently, but they kept the testing hostage. So how do we approach genetic testing? We do sequence analysis of a gene. That's what we historically have done. And then we want to look for large rearrangements. So do like an MOPA or something to look for deletions or duplications within the gene. Well, the laboratory had the technology available to do the rearrangement analysis completely of BRCA1 and BRCA2, but unless the patient met very specific criteria that they arbitrarily came up with, the patient would have to pay $500 out of pocket for that as an additional test. Not very ethical. Okay? So prior to May of 2012, there were a number of people who had BRCA testing but didn't have full testing. And there were a number of women who falsely thought they did not have a BRCA mutation, but the test they had just didn't detect it. In May of 2012, it became standard of care through NCCN and other organizations that when approaching testing of the BRCA1 and 2 genes, like every other gene we do, that we fully look at them. But even today, 6 years later, we have insurance companies that say things like, we're not going to cover that additional testing. We're just going to do that sequencing test. We'll cover that for the patient. So it's become this kind of monster within the healthcare system that this one laboratory had the ability to test for these two genes and basically put all of the standard of practice in care. You have a question? They lost the patent in 13. So then they lost the patent because other labs were like, this isn't fair. How can they patent a gene? It's all of our information. Free our genes, okay? So then they tried to say it was proprietary information because of the technology that they had. So they tried all sorts of ways to keep a market share, an exclusive market share of testing for BRCA1 and 2. We don't test through them anymore because some of these ethical issues. It is what it is. Okay, so this poor woman, 44, had BRCA1 and 2 testing, and I'm thinking she's coming back. Maybe she has a BRCA mutation that we couldn't detect before. Her mom had ovarian cancer. Her mom only had a brother. So it's a very small family structure. I'm getting a little nervous. Dad, interestingly, had a sarcoma at 70 on his calf. Her uncle, who is her father's identical twin, had colon cancer in his 40s. There was an aunt who had ovarian cancer in her 30s. Ovarian cancers are a really significant diagnosis. We generally don't detect them at early stages. So often women don't live very long when they have an ovarian cancer. So I had questions left and right if this was truly an ovarian cancer because she was like 30 years out from her diagnosis. So our patient comes back to clinic for updated testing. We have these panels now. We can look at BRCA1 and 2 again. And the update in the family history was actually that her brother was diagnosed with a Gleason 7 prostate cancer at 46. Again, anything under like 60 is a young prostate cancer. So I'm getting more and more nervous for her, thinking there could really be a BRCA mutation in this family. But actually, her brother had had some genetic testing before she came to clinic, and he was found to have a mutation in a gene called MSH2, Lynch syndrome. He actually has Lynch syndrome. I tested her. She had a big old panel. Everything was completely negative in her. So in this situation, it was appropriate for each individual, based on their personal history, to have genetic testing. We didn't find anything in her. We found Lynch syndrome in him. Not even 100% sure where that came from. I'm a little suspicious it's from the dad's side, but we still can't discount that we see ovarian cancers more often as associated with Lynch syndrome, and the parents weren't available for confirmatory testing. So big differences for her. She gets to still do colonoscopies every 5 years instead of every 1 to 2 years. Okay? So people with Lynch syndrome, higher risks for colon, uterine, and ovarian cancers, but there is growing evidence of the association of breast cancer. There was just a recent article that especially with PMS2 and MSH6, that there are significantly higher risks for women to develop breast cancer. Oh, and I didn't put the family in. So another family I just saw that had an MSH6 mutation, so also had Lynch syndrome. The woman had breast cancer in her 40s. She had a bladder cancer. She had pancreatic cancer diagnosed at age 80. And she had another cancer thrown in there. I'm not exactly sure what it was, but like four cancers. And her mother had breast cancer, and so did four of her aunts. She has Lynch syndrome. And there's all these breast cancers in the family. So again, these families can present very differently. Okay. So I just recently saw a woman who was 44. She was diagnosed with breast cancer. So again, she meets BRCA testing criteria, so we evaluate her. She was young with her breast cancer. But in taking her personal history, she had an astrocytoma, which is a malignant brain tumor. She had some dermatologic features, which I'm going to show you a picture of in just a minute. And in the family history, there weren't breast cancers or ovarian cancers. Her mother had a GIST, a gastrointestinal stromal tumor, involving her small intestine, which is a rare cancer. And her brother had a glioblastoma, which is a rare brain tumor, which is very aggressive. So that's a malignant brain tumor, which he passed away from in his 30s. So here's some of the dermatologic features she had. So she had cafe au lait macules. She had freckling in the armpit area, which is called axillary freckling. And she had some of these lumpy bumpies. She didn't look like this. She only had a few. And these are neurofibromas. So neurofibromatosis type 1 is actually the diagnosis that she has. She, her mom, and her brother all had this condition. So with neurofibromatosis, there literally can be growths at the end of any nerve in the body. When they're dermatologic, they're not a malignancy, but they are bothersome and primarily a cosmetic concern. People can develop plexiform neurofibromas where there can be larger involvement, and that's typically under the skin. It can either cause disfigurement because of the tumor itself, or it could be pushing on other organ systems, primarily affecting the lymphatic system. People can have iris hamartomas, which are called Lish nodules. These are benign little growths in the eyes. And sometimes there can be bony abnormalities, so this is tibial dysplasia. Okay. It's now recognized that women with neurofibromatosis actually have a fourfold increased risk to develop early onset breast cancers. So if you're taking that, 12% lifetime risk to develop breast cancer, we're putting her at a 50% lifetime risk. We weren't watching her. And she was known to have neurofibromatosis. She's getting mammograms, but this happened in between mammograms. So her cancer seems pretty aggressive because she actually palpated it. So it really is in that younger age range to add in those enhanced screenings, add in breast MRIs into mammograms, because those women are at greatly increased risk. Certainly there's a bunch of other cancer risks and health complications people with NF1 can have. Her mother had the GIST. Her brother actually did have an optic nerve tumor. She and her brother had brain tumors. And the most significant cause for shortened lifespan are either these malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumors, but people can have a lot of vasculopathy issues. Okay. Here's another case report. So this woman had a family history of breast and ovarian cancers, and because her mom had ovarian cancer, her gynecologist was actually watching her more closely for ovarian cancer risk. And we talked about how poor screening ovarian cancer, for ovarian cancer we have. So he was doing the ultrasound yearly with her and the blood test, this CA125. Well, her CA125 spiked up 1 year. So he said, okay, go off to Roswell, see what they have to tell you. And she even had a CT scan and nothing was seen. So actually, in looking at the family history, she was only being screened for ovarian cancer risk, but her sister had an early onset breast cancer at 42, paternal aunt with breast at 65, first cousin with breast at 50. So there was significant breast cancer risk. We should have probably been watching her with breast MRIs given her family history. So we did genetic testing with her, and she actually had both a BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation. If we are looking at risks, these are not additive. We really just kind of quote the highest risk for each of those genes because they're in the same pathway. Wherever the pathway is broke, it doesn't matter if it was BRCA1 or 2, that pathway is not working in her body. So it doesn't make the risks even more significant. Again, this is more common in people who have a higher carrier frequency, so people who have Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, this is much more common that this happens, but this is really rare. So I was really surprised that this was her result. This makes a huge difference when it comes to looking at other people in her family. So if we go back to the family tree, that means she got a BRCA1 mutation and a BRCA2 mutation. Where'd they come from? Did one come from mom and one come from dad? Did one of her parents have both? So there could be risk for her siblings. They have a 50-50 chance for each, the BRCA1 mutation and the BRCA2 mutation, and similarly her children. I actually did see her daughter, and she only had the BRCA1 mutation, which was good. Okay. Here's another example of a woman with multiple primaries. So this was a lady with bilateral breast cancer. Her first diagnosis was at 38. In between her breast cancer, she had a thyroid cancer, but she also had a pretty significant family history of colon cancer. And so I think years ago, she actually did have BRCA testing, so she was coming in for update testing. And so we kind of seen a number of malignancies in the family, so she had a pretty significant history herself. Her sister had was diagnosed with very advanced breast cancer at 66 and passed away a short time later. But looking up through mom's side of the family here, all the little greens are colon cancers. Mom had colon cancer at 40, a half-brother with colon at 69, aunt with colon at 44, grandmother with colon in her 70s. But there's also a pancreatic and a prostate cancer. So I was taking, let's take bets. Is it a BRCA family? Is it a Lynch family? Because actually, this family history meets the clinical diagnostic criteria, the Amsterdam criteria for a clinical diagnosis of Lynch syndrome. So there's three individuals in the family. They're all first-degree relatives of one another. They span over two generations, and one of them was diagnosed with colon cancer under age 50. So this family meets those criteria, a very classic-looking Lynch family. So we did a big old panel for her, and she has a mutation in a gene called CHEK2. What do we know about CHEK2 right now? Not that. Certainly not that history. So about a 2 to 3-fold increased risk to develop breast cancer. So we start doing MRIs in addition to mammograms, so kind of similarly that we've been doing all along for other risks. And the management I'm quoting is typically through what's established through NCCN right now. We do know that historically we see a propensity of bilateral breast cancers in families with CHEK2 mutations, and we see colon cancers more often. But we think that that risk is about a 2-fold higher risk. So we still don't know what's going on in the family tree. Could this family have Lynch syndrome and just she doesn't? Could this family all have this CHEK2 mutation accounting for those cancers? We don't know. Unfortunately, they're deceased, and we're not going to find out. But we know that there's a wide range of cancers that we can see in families with CHEK2 mutations. Again, she had a thyroid cancer. We can see thyroid cancers more often. We can see melanomas, prostates, uterine cancer, so a wide variety of cancers. Okay. This woman was actually diagnosed with breast cancer at 46. and just shy of her 5-year clear mark, she was diagnosed with diffuse MET, so brain and bone metastatic disease, unfortunately. And in looking back in her family history and her personal history, it was kind of just barely mentioned in her clinic notes that she actually had colon cancer at 36. That's pretty significant. And even more so, she was being diagnosed as if she has a condition called familial adenomatous polyposis, or FAP. Because at the time of her diagnosis, she was found to have polyposis, lots of colon polyps, in this case greater than 80. FAP, you've heard of?
Yeah.
Okay, a lot probably. So FAP, typically hundreds to thousands of colon polyps. Those individuals develop. They're typically starting to develop in teenage years. So even at 36, that's not the hugest number of polyps for somebody with FAP. So maybe it was more of an attenuated presentation or a later onset presentation. But this breast cancer is not associated with FAP at all. In looking at the family tree, again, a whole lot of nothing. Parents were cancer-free, maybe a few polyps for each of them, an old prostate cancer, nothing much that we're looking at. So we actually did, again, in one of these multi-gene panels, and she has mutations in both copies of a gene called MUTYH or MYH. So she has a condition called MAP or MUTYH-associated polyposis. Say that 10 times fast. So MAP is actually a differential diagnosis for people with FAP, because we think about colon polyps, not breast cancer. But we know people with this condition, while developing colon polyps and have a higher risk for colon cancer, do develop breast cancers, and that can be variable in families. For example, Okay. For example, we have an 83-year-old patient who had a total of 6 colon polyps, but had colon cancer at a young age and also had bilateral breast cancer. And this is what she has. So it doesn't look like FAP in everyone. And it's a deficit in our guidelines right now in looking at this gene as it's associated with breast cancer risk. There aren't guidelines of whom to look at based on their history. So for her and her family, certainly we want to start colonoscopies younger, do upper endoscopies, because there can be polyps in the upper GI tract, specifically the duodenum. But this condition is autosomal recessive, and that's the difference. So if we're looking back at the family tree, we know she got one mutation from mom and one mutation from dad. It's common to be a carrier of this condition in the general population. About 1% of the population has at least one copy of this gene mutated. So for her siblings have a 1 in 4 chance to have this same condition. Her daughter is a carrier, but her daughter's status of having this condition would depend on her father. And she's already had some polyps in her 20s. So I was a little bit nervous for her, but she never came in. Okay. In getting out of approaching necessarily from a personal and family history of risk, we're again now getting to the era of personalized medicine. So instead of trying to just see if a medication works or see if a chemotherapy is that cancer is responsive to a certain therapy like a chemotherapy, we can do genetic profiling of a cancer to look at the alterations in those cancer cells to partner therapies for that. So in this case, my patient was 54. She was diagnosed with breast cancer. Not much to report there. And here's her family tree. So it was really significant. Mom had bilateral breast and ovarian cancer. There's an uncle with prostate. There's breast and ovarians all over the place. But there's a BRCA1 mutation in the family. So the patient had testing for it and does not have it. When she was being evaluated, she was having some hematologic abnormalities, so they were actually evaluating her for myelodysplastic syndrome. So they did a test called Foundation 1 Heme on a blood sample of hers. If you're looking at somebody's blood sample, that's germline testing. And if they don't have a cancer or an abnormality in those blood cells, that's a germline result, even if the intent of the test was not to look that way, okay? If there are cancer cells in the blood, those can contaminate a hereditary test because we're really looking for the genetic makeup of those cancer cells. Though the test is intended to reflect these acquired genetic changes that may be seen in a cancer or in myelodysplastic syndrome, it still may reveal hereditary changes. And so for our patient, she actually had an error in a gene called PALB2. And so this was really when the Foundation 1 test, those somatic tumor tests were coming out. So we saw her to do confirmatory testing on a blood sample. So she already had this done, but it was really that it was in a CLIA certified lab. It was a clinical test looking for a hereditary change, and certainly she had this mutation. Don't know where it's coming from in the family. Her mom never had testing for PALB2, but this explains her breast cancer. She has upwards of a fourfold increased risk to develop breast cancer. We can see pancreatic cancers more commonly, and there's growing evidence about ovarian cancers and prostate cancers. And certainly this can impact medical management for her, but also for her children. Now, PALB2, as well as BRCA2, can be inherited in a recessive fashion and actually cause Fanconi anemia, so this can impact family planning as well for family members. This poor man. So this gentleman was 64 when I saw him. He was initially diagnosed with a Gleason 7 prostate cancer at 61. And then he was diagnosed with metastatic gallbladder cancer at 63. So this is a rare cancer. And so they were looking for treatment options for him. So they did one of these tumor tests. And in that tumor test, they found a BRCA2 mutation. In looking at his family tree, so again, he had prostate and gallbladder, his sister with melanoma, a sister with kidney cancer, mom had a late onset breast, and then there was a younger prostate cancer and a cousin. But not exactly, again, the most striking family. This doesn't really look like a BRCA2 family. There's plenty of women in the family. The person connecting some of the people lived to 95 and didn't have any cancer. So when we were kind of going through, I said, no, I think this could pan out. It may or may not, but I think that this could be a real finding in you, and it could have a big impact on your kids. However, if we're looking only at one change in one gene, that's pretty limited. So again, we did a multi-gene panel in him. So we did a 34-gene panel. It assessed for all the breast cancer genes, all the colon cancer genes, all the prostate cancer genes. Because at this point, while we were looking for treatment guidance for him, so with BRCA2, you can use those PARP inhibitors, but at the same time, he is dying of this cancer. There is no way to sugarcoat that. And so he really wanted to get information for his children, so the next generation. He actually had both BRCA2 and PMS2 mutations. Huge difference. So he was already being treated with olaparib for the BRCA2 mutation, but this kind of opened up the door that he could have another therapeutic intervention. So with tumors that show mismatch repair deficiency, Keytruda is the new medication that can be used, that immunotherapy to attack those cancer cells. Obviously, people with Lynch syndrome and have a Lynch syndrome-associated cancer have mismatch repair deficiency. So this not only gave additional information for his children, because again, they have risk to have both of those conditions, but it opened up therapeutic interventions. I'm very disappointed in his physician, because to give him Keytruda, the physician said, we need evidence within the cancer itself that it's actually mismatch repair deficient. To me, he has a gallbladder cancer and he's dying and he's got Lynch syndrome. Give this poor man this medicine, see if it can help him. So she ordered IHC testing to screen for MLH1, MSH2, PMS2, and MSH6 protein expression in his gallbladder tumor, and it was normal. Okay, so it could be that the BRCA2 mutation is explaining his gallbladder tumor, but the nature of the mutation that he had a full exon deletion. He could have a protein produced by this PMS2 gene, but it's just not functioning correctly. So that IHC result could have been a false positive. So he was not given this medication. He did not have the additional step of microsatellite instability testing on the tumor. And so he unfortunately passed away without having additional treatment options. huge difference to his children, certainly, because they're at risk for both of these conditions. And again, there can be overlap between these two conditions. Okay. When we're looking at these results and families, the tumor is one way, so we want to get people referred who have suspicious results based on their tumor tests. So if there's a BRCA2 mutation, it's at a 48% allele frequency, it's been reported clinically as a mutation, we want to see that person to confirm if it's germline. If it is a TP53 mutation at a 3% allele frequency, it is probably just that cancer. We don't need to see all of those people. So we want to kind of constructively look at those tumor screening results and figure out who we need to see. Something I forgot to mention, see PMS2 mutation? That wasn't found on his tumor test. This lab that does the test that he had does not even include PMS2 on their platform. So it was kind of a mess. Okay. In looking at cancer cells, germline results may be revealed, or they may be masked. Cancers have a lot of structural rearrangements in their chromosomes, so it may be masked that there's a germline mutation present, but could not be identified based on looking at the tumor. We have had labs that identified hereditary changes and specifically excluded them from the results of this somatic testing because we're only doing somatic testing and we thought it was hereditary, so we didn't report it out. Not good. Remember, looking at a blood sample, especially if somebody has really no evidence of a malignancy, that really is doing a germline test, and a lot of physicians in the hematologic clinics, and especially evaluating for leukemias and myelodysplastic syndromes, are doing these types of tumor profile tests. So genotype, phenotype, obviously multiple genes can cause higher cancer risk for breast cancer. They may or may not be associated with other health issues or cancer risks. The same genetic change in one individual, even within the same family, has different outcomes. These are not 100% risks to develop a cancer. They're a risk factor. Certainly, we can see the value that it really influences things like surgical planning, different treatment options like Keytruda and olaparib, those targeted therapies, and certainly information for family members. And that ended early to get you guys out of here. All right, questions? It is very affordable nowadays. So when I first started, those just BRCA 1 and 2, $4,400 list price. Now we could get a panel for $200 to $400 cash. So if you just want to pay out of pocket and write a check, a couple hundred dollars. Okay. Any other questions? All right, guys. If you do, here's my email and extension around there. All right. Thank you. Thanks.